This is Jeff Riddle, pastor of Christ Reformed Baptist Church in Louisa, Virginia, and I'm going to be reading a book review that was written by T.S. Eliot of the New English Bible, which appeared in the Sunday Telegraph, number 98, 16 December 1962, page 7. First, a little biography about the author of this review. Thomas Stearns, or T.S. Eliot, lived from 1888 to 1965. He was an essayist, poet, playwright, publisher, and literary critic, perhaps best known for his poems like The Wasteland, which appeared in 1922. Though born in the U.S., he became a naturalized British citizen in 1927. He won the Nobel Prize in Literature in 1948. Eliot also converted to Anglicanism from Unitarianism in 1927. Whatever his spiritual beliefs, he was an admirer of the Authorized Version, both for its religious, liturgical, and especially literary value. And again, he wrote this review in 1962 when the New Testament portion of the New English Bible had come out. So here is the review. There are three points of view from which any translation of the Bible may be examined: that of doctrine, that of accuracy of translation, and that of English prose style. In what follows, I am concerned only with the question of style. The translation of the Bible, undertaken over 350 years ago at the suggestion of King James I, was made by the best scholars in the kingdom. It was a revision of previous translations. The task was parceled out between six committees, and a general committee spent over 2 years in revising the work of the six. In preparation of the New English Bible, of which only the New Testament has been completed and published, an equally careful procedure has been followed. There have been four panels, of which one has been responsible for the New Testament, and another is responsible for the literary revision of the whole. Again, the committees have been enlisted from among the best scholars in the kingdom, and this time, with complete freedom of choice, for denominational considerations have played no part. The age covered by the reigns of Elizabeth I and James I was richer in writers of genius than is our own, and we should not expect a translation made in our time to be a masterpiece of our literature, or, as was the Authorized Version of 1611, an exemplar of English prose for successive generations of writers. We are, however, entitled to expect from a panel chosen from among the most distinguished scholars of our day at least a work of dignified mediocrity. When we find that we are offered something far below that modest level, something which astonishes in its combination of the vulgar, the trivial, and the pedantic, we ask in alarm, what is happening to the English language? I shall give a few quotations in illustration before examining the principles of translation adopted by the translators as set forth in the introduction, principles which seem to me to take us some way towards understanding the frequent errors of taste in the translation itself. The translation of a passage may be subjected to criticism on several grounds. I can illustrate this very well by examining a sentence in St. Matthew, hereinafter referred to as Matthew in conformity with the New English Bible, the earlier version of which will be a familiar quotation to many, even of those who are ignorant of the Scriptures. Do not feed your pearls to pigs. We notice first the substitution of pigs for swine. The complete Oxford Dictionary says that swine is now literary, but does not say that it is obsolete. I presume, therefore, that in substituting pigs for swine, the translators were trying to choose a word nearer to common speech, even if at the sacrifice of dignity. I should have thought, however, that the word swine would be understood not only by country folk, who may have heard of swine fever, but even of by the urban public, since it is still applied, I believe, to human beings as a term of abuse. Next, I should have thought that the sentence would be more in accordance with English usage if the direct and indirect objects were transposed, thus, do not feed your pigs upon your pearls. To make pearls the direct object is, if I am not mistaken, an Americanism, and my belief is confirmed rather than dispelled by the examples of this usage given in the Oxford English Dictionary. The most unfortunate result, however, is that the substitution of feed for cast makes the figure of speech ludicrous. There is all the difference in the world between saying that pigs do not appreciate the value of pearls and saying what the youngest and most illiterate among us know, that they cannot be nourished on pearls. This is not the only instance in which a figure of speech or illustration has been ruined, though in some other places rather by literalness, as no man can be slave to two masters, which ceases to carry any admonition and becomes merely a flat statement about the condition of slavery. Or how can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye, when all the time there is that plank in your own? May be literally accurate, but will certainly, if it is read in church, raise a giggle among the choir boys. As for the house built upon sand, down it fell with a great crash. As for clarity, I find some passages more puzzling in the New English Bible than in the Authorized Version. Surely others besides myself will take no comfort from being told, as the first beatitude, how blessed are those who know that they are poor. The translator of Luke is more nearly in accord with the Authorized Version here. And the unlearned, on being told that a man who divorces his wife must give her a note of dismissal, will marvel at the apparent facility with which the Hebrews could get rid of their wives. Bill of divorcement, even though it gives no clearer notion of the process required by Jewish law, at least sounds ceremonious. The foregoing examples are all taken from the Gospel according to Matthew, an evangelist who seems to have been especially unlucky in his translator. The other Gospels, however, conform to the same style, or absence of style, in their monotonous inferiority of phrasing. I wish, nevertheless, to quote one brief passage in order to give the translator of Luke his due, Luke 3:14-15. To the soldiers who ask what they should do, John the Baptist replies, no bullying, no blackmail, make do with your pay. I admit gladly that lapses of taste are less offensive when committed against a letter, that is to say, against what we have known heretofore as an epistle, than when committed against a gospel. And there is much more justification, I will even say need, for modern translations of the epistles than for modern translations of the gospels. Some years ago, Dr. J. H. Oldham lent me the translation of St. Paul's epistles made by Gerald War Cornish, who fell in action, I believe, in the First World War. It struck me as admirable and very useful. To imagine, however, that a modern translation can make St. Paul's meaning clear is an exaggeration. What it can make clear is what the familiarity of the Authorized Version may disguise from us, the fact that St. Paul, is a difficult writer. A modern translation makes it easier for us to get to grips with the thought of St. Paul. It does not relieve us of the necessity of using our own minds, any more than can a translation of Kant's Critique of Pure Reason. And if the translations of Paul in the New English Bible did not offend our taste with Boedian absurdities similar to those in the translations of the Gospels, for example, Paul formulated the charge that Jews and Greeks alike are under the power of sin, they might take a respectable place among the modern translations. I do not propose to prolong my inventory of verbal infelicities in the New English Bible. The Times Literary Supplement of 24th March 1961 had an excellent article on language in the New Bible, and the Trinitarian Bible Society has issued as a leaflet a useful list of specimens of bad taste, compiled by the Reverend Terence H. Brown, and available at the price of one penny. The instances I have given will suffice to prepare the way for an examination of the principles which the translators have set before themselves. These find their statement in the introduction. I do not think that this introduction has yet received enough attention. According to the introduction, the translators have set before themselves several aims: fidelity to what the author wrote, clarity, finer shades of idiom than in the Authorized Version, to say in their own native idiom what they believe the author to be saying in his, and contemporaneity. We are told that the language of the Authorized Version is even more definitely archaic and less generally understood than it was 80 years ago when the Revised Version was prepared. for the rate of change in English usage has accelerated. I put this clause in italics because it seems to me significant and ominous. The English usage of 80 years ago, we are told, is out of date. And if the rate of change has accelerated, is it not likely to continue the acceleration? What is likely to be the fate of the New English Bible 80 years hence? We are then told that for a version more modern than that of 1881, an attempt should be made consistently to use the idiom of contemporary English to convey the meaning of the Greek. This requirement of contemporaneity is emphasized at the end of the same paragraph. The present translators have been enjoined, italics mine, to replace Greek constructions and idioms by those of contemporary English. No attempt is made to substantiate the assertion that the rate of change of English usage has accelerated, or to inform us in what respects English usage is changing. It does not seem to have occurred to the mind of the anonymous author of this introduction that change can sometimes be for the worse, and that it is much our business to attempt to arrest deterioration and combat corruption of our language as to accept change. Nor are we given any definition of contemporaneity. Is it to be found in the writing of the best contemporary writers of English prose? And if so, who are they? And who is to decide who they are? Or is it to be found in colloquial speech? And if so, at what level of literacy? Will the readers who find sweated all day in the blazing sun suits them better than borne the burden of the heat of the day be the same as those who find extirpate more contemporary than destroy? When we turn to the description on the jacket, we find that the aim was to be in style, neither traditional nor modernistic. If style is to be contemporary without being modernistic, the words contemporary and modernistic should be carefully defined. At the time when the New English Bible was published, it seems that Dr. Dodd appeared in a television program and explained the purposes for which it was designed. As I did not hear him on that occasion, I quote from the article in the Times Literary Supplement, to which I referred earlier. In a helpful television program, Dr. Dodd, the director of the Enterprise, told viewers whom the New Bible was intended for. It was, he said, for people who do not go to church, for a rising generation less well educated than formerly in classical and literary traditions, and for churchgoers so well accustomed to the language of the Authorized Version that they may have come to find it soothing rather than meaningful. So long as the New English Bible is used only for private reading, it would be merely a symptom of the decay of the English language in the middle of the 20th century. But the more it is adopted for religious services, the more it will become an active agent of decadence. There may be ministers of the gospel who do not realize that the music of the phrase, of the paragraph, of the period, is an essential constituent of good English prose, and who fail to understand that the life of a reading of gospel and epistle in the liturgy is in this music of the spoken word. The first appearance of the New English Bible in churches has, I believe, been in the reading of the epistle for the day. Nothing will be gained for the new version will be just as hard to grasp when read in church as the Authorized Version, and it will lack the verbal beauty of the Authorized Version. To understand any version, we must study it at home or under direction. And if use of the New English Bible letters in churches is followed by the adoption of the New English Bible Gospels, must we not look forward to the day when the collects of Cranmer are revised for use in Anglican churches to make them conform to contemporary English? It is good that those who aspire to write good English prose or verse should be prepared by the study of Greek and Latin. It would also be good if those who have authority to translate a dead language could show understanding and appreciation of their own language.